Part 1. The Advantages of Disadvantages and the Disadvantages of Advantages. Some pretend to be rich, yet have nothing. Others pretend to be poor, yet have great wealth. Proverbs 13:7. Chapter 1. Vivek Ranadive. It was really random. I mean, my father had never played basketball before. 1. When Vivek Ranadive decided to coach his daughter Anjali's basketball team, he settled on two principles. The first was that he would never raise his voice. This was National Junior Basketball, the Little League of Basketball. The team was made up mostly of 12-year-olds, and 12-year-olds, he knew from experience, did not respond well to shouting. He would conduct business on the basketball court, he decided, the same way he conducted business at his software firm. He would speak calmly and softly, and he would persuade the girls of the wisdom of his approach with appeals to reason and common sense. The second principle was more important. Ranadive was puzzled by the way Americans play basketball. He is from Mumbai. He grew up with cricket and soccer. He would never forget the first time he saw a basketball game. He thought it was mindless. Team A would score and then immediately retreat to its own end of the court. Team B would pass the ball in from the sidelines and dribble it into Team A's end, where Team A was patiently waiting. Then the process would reverse itself. A regulation basketball court is 94 feet long. Most of the time, a team would defend only about 24 feet of that, conceding the other 70 feet. Occasionally, teams played a full-court press. That is, they contested their opponent's attempt to advance the ball up the court. But they did it for only a few minutes at a time. It was as if there was a kind of conspiracy in the basketball world about the way the game ought to be played, Ranadive thought, and that conspiracy had the effect of widening the gap between good teams and weak teams. Good teams, after all, had players who were tall and could dribble and shoot well. They could crisply execute their carefully prepared plays in their opponent's end. Why, then, did weak teams play in a way that made it easy for good teams to do the very thing they were so good at? Ranadive looked at his girls. Morgan and Julia were serious basketball players. But Nikki, Angela, Danny, Holly, Annika, and his own daughter Anjali had never played the game before. They weren't that tall. They couldn't shoot. They weren't particularly adept at dribbling. They were not the sort who played pickup games at the playground every evening. Ranadive lives in Menlo Park, in the heart of California's Silicon Valley. His team was made up of, as Ranadive put it, little blonde girls. They were the daughters of nerds and computer programmers. They worked on science projects and read long and complicated books and dreamed about growing up to be marine biologists. Ranadive knew that if they played the conventional way, if they let their opponents dribble the ball up the court without opposition, they would almost certainly lose to the girls for whom basketball was a passion. Ranadive had come to America as a 17-year-old with $50 in his pocket. He was not one to accept losing easily. His second principle, then, was that his team would play a real full-court press, every game, all the time. The team ended up at the national championships. It was really random, Anjali Ranadive said. I mean, my father had never played basketball before. 2. Suppose you were to total up all the wars over the past 200 years that occurred between very large and very small countries. Let's say that one side has to be at least 10 times larger in population and armed might than the other. How often do you think the bigger side wins? Most of us, I think, would put that number at close to 100%. A tenfold difference is a lot. But the actual answer may surprise you. When the political scientist Ivan Araguin Toft did the calculation a few years ago, he came up with 71.5%. Just under a third of the time, the weaker country wins. Araguin Toft then asked the question slightly differently. What happens in wars between the strong and the weak when the weak side does as David did and refuses to fight the way the bigger side wants to fight, using unconventional or guerrilla tactics? The answer? In those cases, the weaker party's winning percentage climbs from 28.5% to 63.6%. To put that in perspective, the United States' population is 10 times the size of Canada's. If the two countries went to war and Canada chose to fight unconventionally, history would suggest that you ought to put your money on Canada. We think of underdog victories as improbable events. That's why the story of David and Goliath has resonated so strongly all these years. But Aragorn Toff's point is that they aren't at all. Underdogs win all the time. Why then are we so shocked every time a David beats a Goliath? Why do we automatically assume that someone who is smaller or poorer or less skilled is necessarily at a disadvantage? One of the winning underdogs on Aragorn Toff's list, for example, was T.E. Lawrence, or as he is better known, Lawrence of Arabia, who led the Arab revolt against the Turkish army occupying Arabia near the end of the First World War. The British were helping the Arabs in their uprising, and their goal was to destroy the long railroad the Turks had built, running from Damascus deep into the Hejaz desert. It was a daunting task. The Turks had a formidable modern army. Lawrence, by contrast, commanded an unruly band of Bedouin. They were not skilled troops. They were nomads. Sir Reginald Wingate, one of the British commanders in the region, called them an untrained rabble, most of whom have never fired a rifle. But they were tough, and they were mobile. The typical Bedouin soldier carried no more than a rifle, 100 rounds of ammunition, and 45 pounds of flour, which meant that he could travel as much as 110 miles a day across the desert, even in summer. The Bedouin carried no more than a pint of drinking water, since they were so good at finding water in the desert. "Our cards were speed and time, not hitting power," Lawrence wrote. "Our largest available resources were the tribesmen, men quite unused to formal warfare, whose assets were movement, endurance, individual intelligence, knowledge of the country, courage." The 18th century general Maurice de Saxe famously said that the art of war was about legs, not arms, and Lawrence's troops were all legs. In one typical stretch in the spring of 1917, his men dynamited 60 rails and cut a telegraph line at Buer on March 24th, sabotaged a train and 25 rails at Abu al-Nam on March 25th, dynamited 15 rails and cut a telegraph line at Istabul Antar on March 27th, raided a Turkish garrison and derailed a train on March 29th, returned to Buer and sabotaged the railway line again on March 31st, dynamited 11 rails at Hedia on April 3rd, raided the train line in the area of Wadi Daiji on April 4th and 5th, and attacked twice on April 6th. Lawrence's masterstroke was an assault on the port town of Aqaba. The Turks expected an attack from British ships patrolling the waters of the Gulf of Aqaba to the west. Lawrence decided to attack from the east instead, coming at the city from the unprotected desert. And to do that, he led his men on an audacious 600-mile loop, up from the Hejaz, north into the Syrian desert, and then back down towards Aqaba. This was in summer, through some of the most inhospitable land in the Middle East, and Lawrence tacked on a side trip to the outskirts of Damascus in order to mislead the Turks about his intentions. This year, the valley seemed creeping with horned vipers and puff adders, cobras and black snakes, Lawrence writes in Seven Pillars of Wisdom about one stage in the journey. "We could not lightly draw water after dark, for there were snakes swimming in the pools or clustering in knots around their brinks. Twice puff adders came twisting into the alert ring of our debating coffee circle. Three of our men died of bites. Four recovered after great fear and pain and a swelling of the poisoned limb. How we taught treatment was to bind up the part with snake skin plaster and read chapters of the Quran to the sufferer until he died." When they finally arrived at Aqaba, Lawrence's band of several hundred warriors killed or captured 1,200 Turks and lost only 2 men. The Turks simply had not thought that their opponent would be crazy enough to come at them from the desert. Sir Reginald Wingate called Lawrence's men an untrained rabble. He saw the Turks as the overwhelming favorites. But can you see how strange that was? Having lots of soldiers and weapons and resources, as the Turks did, is an advantage. But it makes you immobile and puts you on the defensive. Meanwhile, movement, endurance, individual intelligence, knowledge of the country, and courage, which Lawrence's men had in abundance, allowed them to do the impossible, namely attack Aqaba from the east a strategy so audacious the Turks never saw it coming. There is a set of advantages that have to do with material resources, and there is a set that have to do with the absence of material resources. And the reason underdogs win as often as they do is that the latter are sometimes every bit the equal of the former. For some reason, this is a very difficult lesson for us to learn. We have, I think, a very rigid and limited definition of what an advantage is. We think of things as helpful that actually aren't, and think of other things as unhelpful that are. Part one of David and Goliath is an attempt to explore the consequences of that error. When we see the giant, why do we automatically assume the battle is his for the winning? And what does it take to be that person who doesn't accept the conventional order of things as a given, like David, or Lawrence of Arabia, or, for that matter, Vivek Ranadive and his band of nerdy Silicon Valley girls? 3. Vivek Ranadive's basketball team played in the National Junior Basketball 7th and 8th grade division, representing Redwood City. The girls practiced at Pay's Place, a gym in nearby San Carlos. Because Ranadive had never played basketball, he recruited a couple of experts to help him. The first was Roger Craig, a former professional athlete who worked for Ranadive's software company. After Craig signed on, he recruited his daughter, Ramitra, who had played basketball in college. Ramitra was the kind of person you assign to guard your opponent's best player in order to render her useless. The girls on the team loved Ramitra. "She has always been like my big sister," Anjali Ranadive said. "It was so awesome to have her along." Redwood City's strategy was built around the two deadlines that all basketball teams must meet in order to advance the ball. The first is the time allotted for the inbounds pass. When one team scores, a player from the other team takes the ball out of bounds and has 5 seconds to pass it to a teammate on the court. If that deadline is missed, the ball goes to the other team. Usually, that's not an issue, because teams don't hang around to defend against the inbounds pass. They run back to their own end. Redwood City did not do that. Each girl on the team closely shadowed her counterpart. When some teams play the press, the defender plays behind the offensive player she's guarding in order to impede her once she catches the ball. The Redwood City girls, by contrast, played a more aggressive, high-risk strategy. They positioned themselves in front of their opponents to prevent them from catching the inbounds pass in the first place. And they didn't have anyone guard the player throwing the ball in. Why bother? Ranadive used that extra player as a floater who could serve as a second defender against the other team's best player. "Think about football," Ranadive said. "The quarterback can run with the ball. He has the whole field to throw to, and it's still damn difficult to complete a pass." Basketball was harder. A smaller court, a 5-second deadline, a heavier, bigger ball. As often as not, the teams Redwood City was playing against simply couldn't make the inbounds pass within the 5-second limit. Or else the inbounding player, panicked by the thought that her 5 seconds were about to be up, would throw the ball away. Or her pass would be intercepted by one of the Redwood City players. Ranadive's girls were maniacal. The second deadline in basketball requires a team to advance the ball across midcourt into the opponent's end within 10 seconds. And if Redwood City's opponents met the first deadline and were able to make the inbounds pass in time, the girls would turn their attention to the second deadline. They would descend on the girl who had caught the inbounds pass and trap her. Anjali was the designated trapper. She'd sprint over and double-team the dribbler, stretching her long arms high and wide. Maybe she'd steal the ball. Maybe the other player would throw it away in a panic or get bottled up and stalled so that the ref would end up blowing the whistle. "When we first started out, no one knew how to play defense or anything," Anjali said. "So my dad said the whole game long, your job is to guard someone and make sure they never get the ball on inbounds plays. It's the best feeling in the world to steal a ball from someone. We would press and steal and do that over and over again. It made people so nervous. There were teams that were a lot better than us that had been playing a long time, and we would beat them." The Redwood City players would jump ahead 4-0, 6-0, 8-0, 12-0. One time they led 25-0. Because they typically got the ball underneath their opponent's basket, they rarely had to attempt the low-percentage long-range shots that require skill and practice. They shot layups. In one of the few games that Redwood City lost that year, only 4 of the team's players showed up. They pressed anyway. Why not? They lost by only 3 points. What that defense did for us is that we could hide our weaknesses, Ramicha Craig said. We could hide the fact that we didn't have good outside shooters. We could hide the fact that we didn't have the tallest lineup. Because as long as we played hard on defense, we were getting steals and getting easy layups. I was honest with the girls. I told them, we're not the best basketball team out there, but they understood their roles. A 12-year-old girl would go to war for Ramitra. They were awesome, she said. Lawrence attacked the Turks where they were weak, along the farthest deserted outpost of the railroad, and not where they were strong. Redwood City attacked the inbounds pass, the point in a game where the great team is as vulnerable as a weak one. David refused to engage Goliath in close quarters, where he would surely lose. He stood well back, using the full valley as his battlefield. The girls of Redwood City used the same tactic. They defended all 94 feet of the basketball court. The full-court press is legs, not arms. It's the plant's ability with effort. It is basketball for those who, like Lawrence's Bedouin, are quite unused to formal warfare, whose assets are movement, endurance, individual intelligence, and courage. It's an exhausting strategy, Roger Craig said. He and Ranadeve were sitting in a conference room at Ranadeve's software company, reminiscing about their dream season. Ranadeve was at the whiteboard, diagramming the intricacies of the Redwood City press. Craig was sitting at the table. My girls had to be more fit than the others, Ranadeve said. He used to make them run, Craig said, nodding. We followed soccer strategy in practice, Ranadeve said. I would make them run and run and run. I couldn't teach them skills in that short period of time, so all we did was make sure they were fit and had some basic understanding of the game. That's why attitude plays such a big role in this, because you're going to get tired. Ranadeve said, tired, with a note of approval in his voice. His father was a pilot who was jailed by the Indian government because he wouldn't stop challenging the safety of the country's planes. Ranadeve went to MIT after he saw a documentary on the school and decided that it was perfect for him. This was in the 1970s, when going abroad for undergraduate study required the Indian government to authorize the release of foreign currency, and Ranadeve camped outside the office of the governor of the Reserve Bank of India until he got his money. Ranadeve is slender and fine-boned, with a languorous walk and an air of imperturbability, but none of that should be mistaken for nonchalance. The Ranadeves are relentless. He turned to Craig. What was our cheer again? The two men thought for a moment, then shouted out happily, in unison, 1, 2, 3, attitude! The whole Redwood City philosophy was based on a willingness to try harder than anybody else. One time, some new girls joined the team, Ranadeve said, and so in the first practice I had, I was telling them, look, this is what we're going to do, and I showed them. I said, it's all about attitude. And there was this one new girl on the team, and I was worried she wouldn't get the whole attitude thing. Then we did the cheer and she said, no, it's not 1, 2, 3, attitude. It's 1, 2, 3, attitude, ha! At which point, Ranadeve and Craig burst out laughing. 4. In January of 1971, the Fordham University Rams played a basketball game against the University of Massachusetts Redmond. The game was in Amherst, at the legendary arena known as the Cage, where the Redmond hadn't lost since December of 1969. Their record was 11-1. The Redmond star was none other than Julius Erving, Dr. J, one of the greatest athletes ever to play the game of basketball. The UMass team was very, very good. Fordham, on the other hand, was a team of scrappy kids from the Bronx and Brooklyn. Their center had torn up his knee the first week of practice and was out, which meant that their tallest player was 6'5". Their starting forward, and forwards are typically almost as tall as centers, was Charlie Yelverton, who was only 6'2". But from the opening buzzer, the Rams launched a full-court press, and they never let up. We jumped out to a 13-6 lead, and it was a war the rest of the way, Digger Phelps, the Fordham coach at the time, recalls. These were tough city kids. We played you 94 feet. We knew that sooner or later, we were going to make you crack. Phelps sent in one indefatigable Irish or Italian kid from the Bronx after another to guard Erving, and one by one the indefatigable Irish and Italian kids filed out. None of them were as good as Irving. It didn't matter. Fordham won 87-79. In the world of basketball, there is one story after another like this, about legendary games where David used the full-court press to beat Goliath. Yet the puzzle of the press is that it has never become popular. What did Digger Phelps do this season after his stunning upset of UMass? He never used the full-court press the same way again. And the UMass coach, Jack Lehman, who was humbled in his own gym by a bunch of street kids, did he learn from his defeat and use the press himself the next time he had a team of underdogs? He did not. Many people in the world of basketball don't really believe in the press because it's not perfect. It can be beaten by a well-coached team with adept ball handlers and astute passers. Even Ranadive readily admitted as much. All an opposing team had to do to beat Redwood City was press back. The girls were not good enough to handle a taste of their own medicine. But all these objections miss the point. If Ranadive's girls or Fordham's scrappy overachievers had played the conventional way, they would have lost by 30 points. The press was the best chance the underdog had of beating Goliath. Logically, every team that comes in as an underdog should play that way, shouldn't they? So why don't they? Arguin Toft found the same puzzling pattern. When an underdog fought like David, he usually won. But most of the time, underdogs didn't fight like David. Of the 202 lopsided conflicts in Arguin Toft's database, the underdog chose to go toe-to-toe with Goliath the conventional way 152 times, and lost 119 times. In 1809, the Peruvians fought the Spanish straight up and lost. In 1816, the Georgians fought the Russians straight up and lost. In 1817, the Pindaris fought the British straight up and lost. In the Kandyan Rebellion of 1817, the Sri Lankans fought the British straight up and lost. In 1823, the Burmese chose to fight the British straight up and lost. The list of failures is endless. In the 1940s, the communist insurgency in Vietnam bedeviled the French until in 1951, the Vietnamese switched to conventional warfare and promptly suffered a series of defeats. George Washington did the same thing in the American Revolution, abandoning the guerrilla tactics that had served the colonists so well in the conflict's early stages. As quickly as he could, William Polk writes in Violent Politics, A History of Unconventional Warfare, Washington devoted his energies to creating a British-type army, the Continental Line. As a result, he was defeated time after time and almost lost the war. It makes no sense unless you think back to Lawrence's long march across the desert to Aqaba. It is easier to dress soldiers in bright uniforms and have them march to the sound of a fife and drum corps than it is to have them ride 600 miles through snake-infested desert on the back of a camel. It is easier and far more satisfying to retreat and compose yourself after every score and execute perfectly choreographed plays than to swarm about, arms flailing, and contest every inch of the basketball court. Underdog strategies are hard. The only person who seemed to have absorbed the lessons of that famous game between Fordham and the University of Massachusetts was a skinny little guard on the UMass freshman team named Rick Pitino. He didn't play that day. He watched, and his eyes grew wide. Even now, more than four decades later, he can name from memory nearly every player on the Fordham team. Yelverton, Sullivan, Maynard, Charles, Zambetti. They came in with the most unbelievable pressing team I'd ever seen, Pitino said. Five guys between 6 feet five and 6 feet. It was unbelievable how they covered ground. I studied it. There is no way they should have beaten us. Nobody beat us at the cage. Pitino became the head coach at Boston University in 1978, when he was 25 years old, and he used the press to take the school to its first NCAA tournament appearance in 24 years. At his next head coaching stop, Providence College, Pitino took over a team that had gone 11-20 the year before. The players were short and almost entirely devoid of talent, a carbon copy of the Fordham Rams. They pressed and ended up one game away from playing for the national championship. Again and again in his career, Pitino has achieved extraordinary things with a fraction of the talent of his competitors. I have so many coaches come in every year to learn the press, Patino said. He's now the head basketball coach at the University of Louisville, and Louisville has become the mecca for all those Davids trying to learn how to beat Goliath. Then they email me. They tell me they can't do it. They don't know if their players can last. Patino shook his head. We practice every day for 2 hours, he went on. The players are moving almost 98% of the practice. We spend very little time talking. When we make our corrections, that is, when Patino and his coaches stop play to give instruction, they are 7-second corrections, so that our heart rate never rests. We are always working. 7 seconds. The coaches who come to Louisville sit in the stands and watch that ceaseless activity and despair. To play by David's rules, you have to be desperate. You have to be so bad that you have no choice. Their teams are just good enough that they know it could never work. Their players could never be convinced to play that hard. They were not desperate enough. But Ronadeev? Oh, he was desperate. You would think, looking at his girls, that their complete inability to pass and dribble and shoot was their greatest disadvantage. But it wasn't, was it? It was what made their winning strategy possible. 5. One of the things that happened to Redwood City the minute the team started winning basketball games is that opposing coaches began to get angry. There was a sense that Redwood City wasn't playing fair, that it wasn't right to use the full court press against 12-year-old girls who were just beginning to grasp the rudiments of the game. The point of youth basketball, the dissenting chorus said, was to learn basketball skills. Ronadeev's girls, they felt, were not really playing basketball. Of course, you could as easily argue that in playing the press, a 12-year-old girl learned much more valuable lessons, that effort can trump ability, and that conventions are made to be challenged. But the coaches on the other side of Redwood City's lopsided scores were disinclined to be so philosophical. There was one guy who wanted to have a fight with me in the parking lot, Ronadeev said. He was this big guy. He obviously played basketball and football himself, and he saw that skinny foreign guy beating him at his own game. He wanted to beat me up. Roger Craig says that he was sometimes startled by what he saw. The other coaches would be screaming at their girls, humiliating them, shouting at them. They would say to the refs, "That's a foul, that's a foul," but we weren't fouling. We were just playing aggressive defense. One time, we were playing this team from East San Jose, Ronadeev said. They've been playing for years. They were born with the basketball girls. We were just crushing them. We were up something like 20-0. We wouldn't even let them inbound the ball, and the coach got so mad, they took a chair and threw it. He started screaming at his girls, and of course, the more you scream at girls that age, the more nervous they get. Ronadeev shook his head. You should never, ever raise your voice. Finally, the ref physically threw the guy out of the building. I was afraid. I think he couldn't stand it because here were all these blonde-haired girls who were clearly inferior players, and we were killing them. All the qualities that distinguish the ideal basketball player are acts of skill and finely calibrated execution. When the game becomes about effort over ability, it becomes unrecognizable. A shocking mixture of broken plays and flailing limbs and usually competent players panicking and throwing the ball out of bounds. You have to be outside the establishment, a foreigner new to the game, or a skinny kid from New York at the end of the bench, to have the audacity to play it that way. 6. T.E. Lawrence could triumph because he was the farthest thing from a proper British Army officer. He did not graduate with honors from the top English military academy. He was an archaeologist by trade, who wrote dreamy prose. He wore sandals and full Bedouin dress when he went to see his military superiors. He spoke Arabic like a native and handled a camel as if he had been riding one all his life. He didn't care what people in the military establishment thought about his untrained rabble because he had little invested in the military establishment. And then there's David. He must have known that duels with Philistines were supposed to proceed formally with the crossing of swords. But he was a shepherd, which in ancient times was one of the lowliest of all professions. He had no stake in the finer points of military ritual. We spend a lot of time thinking about the ways that prestige and resources and belonging to elite institutions make us better off. We don't spend enough time thinking about the ways in which those kinds of material advantages limit our options. Vivek Ranadive stood on the sidelines as the opposing team's parents and coaches heaped abuse on him. Most people would have shrunk in the face of that kind of criticism. Not Ranadive. It was like really random. I mean, my father had never played basketball before. Why should he care what the world of basketball thought of him? Ranadive coached a team of girls who had no talent in a sport he knew nothing about, and every one of those things turned out to be to his advantage. 7. At the Nationals, the Redwood City girls won their first two games. In the third round, their opponents were from somewhere deep in Orange County. Redwood City had to play them on their own court, and the opponents supplied their own referee as well. The game was at 8 o'clock in the morning. The Redwood City players left their hotel at 6 to beat the traffic. It went downhill from there. The referee did not believe in 1-2-3 attitude, ha! He didn't think that playing to deny the inbounds pass was basketball. He began calling one foul after another. They were touch fouls, Craig said. Ticky-tacky stuff. The memory was painful. My girls didn't understand, Ranadive said. The ref called something like 4 times as many fouls on us as on the other team. People were booing, Craig said. It was bad. A 2-to-1 ratio is understandable, but a ratio of 4-to-1? Ranadive shook his head. One girl fouled out. We didn't get blown out. There was still a chance to win, but Ranadive called the press off. He had to. The Redwood City players retreated to their own end and passively watched as their opponents advanced down the court. The Redwood City girls did not run. They paused and deliberated between each possession. They played basketball the way basketball is supposed to be played, and in the end, they lost. But not before proving that Goliath is not quite the giant he thinks he is.